Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the J.S. Stevens Podcast, a part of the Off the Ball Network. This is episode 210, dedicated to a man who on July 8th in the year 1965 became the first Houston Astros baseball player to hit or to have six hits in one single game. Mr. Joe Morgan. And as always, thank you for listening and downloading another episode of the podcast. On today's episode, we are joined by Mr. Troy Sadowski, former Georgia Bulldog football player, former college football All-American, and even a 10-year NFL vet as well, as he comes on the podcast to talk specifically about his playing days at the University of Georgia. And I got to make a quick shout out very quickly to Philip Jordan, the host of Talking SEC. He's been on the podcast here before. We'll plan on having him here once again before college football season starts because he helped this connection be made. And I am oh so happy and thankful that he did. Troy Sadowski has been on that podcast numerous times. And I said, why not have Troy come over here? Philip Jordan reached out and really helped this connection happen. I thank him for it. Troy Sadowski, a man that has many stories, and he has so many stories that filter through the entire conversation. Some that are goofy early on, even in the middle. And Troy, one thing I loved is him talking about the Clemson-Georgia rivalry that is being rekindled, that is being renewed, reunited. Those two teams are this year, week one of the football season, and I cannot wait for that game, and I'm sure you guys will enjoy my conversation with Mr. Troy Sadowski. One interesting thing about this interview was I have not done a phone interview in quite a long time. Normally, things are done over the Zoom. You can see the person. You can see their mannerisms. You can see their body language. You can see their facial expressions. So it took a whole lot more skill for this interview than normal, but you got to be versatile. You're not always going to be able to look at the person while you're talking to them, and I think you will not really see much difference between this interview and others. Before we get to any of that, my conversation with Mr. Troy Sadowski, ESPN made a very, very, very interesting move recently. And I was doing some thinking, some listening to people talk that used to work at ESPN in regards to what actually took place with Maria Taylor and Rachel Nichols, somebody that has seen Maria Taylor on the sidelines while listening while she was working. I think it was after a Rose Bowl. I remember the Christian McCaffrey Stanford interview that she did. That's what this person referenced on the podcast I listened to. And this was not the first time a news website, an article was written about this very situation. Actually, a year ago now, maybe less than a year ago, Deadspin actually picked this up and wrote about it. I do think right now, like I mentioned on Tuesday, I do think that this situation was exposed right now. One, why would you release a major bombshell of a situation at ESPN during the weekend of the 4th of July, the weekend America is celebrating its freedom? We're supposed to be united, and you're dropping something that's going to divide so many people inside of a network, and maybe more divided than they already were. But also, right before the contract is up of Miss Maria Taylor, like I said earlier, I do think this was kind of strategically done to kind of have some contract leverage. But ESPN, even though it was in the contract of Miss Rachel Nichols to host NBA Countdown during the finals, they decided to remove her from all finals coverage during the NBA Finals. All of it. All of it. So it was originally supposed to be that Maria Taylor would host Countdown, and then they were going to have Rachel Nichols on the sidelines. She was going to make occasional appearances on the NBA Countdown. And then ESPN said, well, we'll have you still on the show, but it'll be pre-recorded. You and Maria will not have to actually talk to each other live on air. Then they decided to remove Rachel Nichols entirely, completely from the broadcast and put in Miss Malika Andrews. That's a phenomenal job. I think she's in her 20s right now, and you would not be able to tell that by the way that she does her job. She is the one working the sidelines. Maria Taylor is right there. And interesting move there to remove somebody that's contractually obligated in writing. You know the old saying, your word is your bond, and you had the whole handshake thing. We're going to shake on it and agree upon it. But then people started to not believe that. So we have things written in writing and contractually obligated to do certain things. But even now, apparently, contracts mean absolutely nothing. I don't know how this is going to work out for Miss Maria Taylor, but there are a couple names that I really think people have forgotten in NBA coverage during the finals. I'm not even knocking Maria Taylor and her talent. I'm not knocking Malika Andrews and her talent. They're both talented at what they do. But what happened to Lisa Salters and Doris Burke? Now, Doris Burke is on the radio call of this year of the NBA Finals. Her, John Berry, Mark Kestisher on the radio call for ESPN Radio. But Lisa Salters has just been removed from all the NBA coverage, and I don't remember any person at all saying Lisa Salters has done a bad job, has ever done a bad job. Actually, I've heard nobody say one bad thing about Miss Lisa Salters. Older black woman, has been around a while, has done a phenomenal job. Why aren't we having people that are seasoned cover the biggest series of the NBA season instead of, oh, contractually obligated? Okay, forget that. Oh, Lisa Salters, you haven't done a bad job. You've done really, really good, but we're trying to get these younger faces in here, even though she's been around a while and has made a lot of connections that these young people have not been able to cultivate just yet. They're not as strong as those that Miss Lisa Salters does. Very interesting. Doris Burke used to be a part of the NBA coverage, even sideline reporting. Not there now. I think she would do a better job than Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson on the TV call. But, you know, ESPN, they want to have their coaches and all that stuff that they do there. I think Hubie Brown would be a better color commentator than Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson. I want to learn some basketball. A lot of times, Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy, they fight, they argue, they bicker over things that are going on. ESPN moving Rachel Nichols from the broadcast of the finals, that's their decision. But I think NBA fans would love Doris Burke on the sidelines. No one would complain. Lisa Salters on the sidelines. Nobody would complain there either. Interesting thing. Maria Taylor, Malika Andrews, they're friends. Of course, you would have friends in the business, especially when you work at that same company. And I think Maria Taylor was very influential in Malika Andrews working up the ranks very, very quickly at ESPN for NBA coverage. ESPN, what's next? I don't know. But myself and other people will be looking at the situation very, very closely to find out and to see what your next move is. Let's go ahead and take a trip to the state of Georgia to enjoy my fun conversation with Mr. Troy Sadowski, 1998 college football All-American. And joining us now here on the Jay Stephens podcast, it is a member of the 1988 All-American college football team and then also a longtime NFL vet as well. It is Mr. Troy Sadowski. Troy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. No problem at all. Troy, we could talk about present day. We could even go to the NFL. But I like to start interviews going back to the things that were going through your mind prior to making the decision to go to the University of Georgia and play college football. What were some thoughts in your mind leading up to you making that decision to play football in Athens, Georgia?
Well, one of the biggest things was my mother at the time was battling breast cancer, and she was also a graduate of the University of Georgia, but staying close to home was very important. So it was also a big motivator to get and earn some playing time early on. So I was able to start all the 4 years that I was there, and I gave my mom an opportunity to see me play for one full season. So that was one of the biggest things, was to make sure that she was able to see that. And then also, I mean, the University of Georgia at the time, you know, the early 1980, the national championship, and then they had a series of conference championships, and then a good outing in the Cotton Bowl. So they were hot as a college football team. So to be a part of that.
So no Atlanta. I understand. I believe Georgia Tech is in Atlanta. No, I think you believe you're from Atlanta. And how far away is Athens? Because I was curious when listening to you. I thought, oh, maybe you would stay close to home. I understand Georgia football better than Georgia Tech, but was Georgia Tech ever an option back then?
It was, until I sent them my transcript, and once they saw that, they figured I wouldn't. I didn't have it academically. Yeah, no, Athens, from where I grew up in the Chamblee area inside the perimeter, Athens was probably a little over an hour's travel But my sister was a graduate of the university in Georgia Tech, so there was always that sibling rivalry. She also went to a local high school called Marist, and we were at Shambly High School on the other side of the track, so to speak. So all through our lives, we had that little sibling rivalry from high school to college.
That's one of those things that I don't believe ever goes away. I have a brother of my own, and we do have our own sibling rivalry, not as intense as it used to be when we were youngsters living together, but the sibling rivalry, I think, is something that even especially in those college years, is something that still sticks, and it sounds like it stuck with you and your sister.
Oh, absolutely. Even to this day, I still give her a hard time about Georgia Tech.
You mentioned the 1980 national championship that Georgia won, but once you got acclimated and you became a starter, what was that team like? Not just freshman year. Let's stick freshman year. Let's stick early. What was it like? What were those early teams like at Georgia once you began and started playing tight end for them?
Well, we were run based offense. You ran the football to set up the pass, play action passes. They called them boots and waggles, misdirection plays. And if you understood, you looked at our roster, when I was there, I mean, we had running backs like Rodney Hampton, Lars Tate, Keith Henderson, Tim Worley, you know, guys that went on. Lars Tate, I think that I mentioned him. These guys went on to play at the next level. And you could alternate. It didn't matter who you put in the backfield, that you had a quality back. And we ran the football. That was our big thing, was running, but we ran the power eye. And if we didn't rush for 350 yards a game, we had a bad day.
Oh, wow. So this is like really, of course, it's 80s football, but this is kind of the conversation and the talk that I had when I played football in high school. The power eye, run heavy. We could throw the ball. We had wide receivers and tight ends that could catch it, but that whole power eye running style, run heavy offense, that's what I'm used to. And I'm sure there may be a youngster or two listening saying, wait, 350 yards on the ground and it's power eye, and these are terms that I don't know about. But back then, Troy, like you mentioned, this is what college football was.
Oh, yeah. You lined up with a fullback in front of the tailback. You ran dive plays to the fullback off the guards, off tackle plays, and our bread and butter play, which is one of the staples of Georgia back then, was the toss sweep. I think that's pretty much what, you know, to end up all conference and all American. They looked at my overall game, and I think a lot of it had to do with my blocking of the toss sweep. I've got some articles from coaches that we played against, that one of the things that they mentioned was that how the tight ends dominated their outside linebackers and sealed the corners.
Is that how you ended up making your mark on the team? Because you think a run-heavy offense, a tight end, would not be utilized in a passing game like it is today. Would you say that blocking, your blocking, the way you excelled on the field, was how you really made your mark and made sure you were a big piece in a certain way of the offense?
Oh, absolutely. The tight end was involved in the game plan every week. We had a big part of that. And absolutely, that's where I got recognized. That was one of the things. I mean, we knew that we were blockers first, receivers second. We were also, all the tight ends played special teams, and we excelled on the special teams. And that's a big part of that when I got to the NFL. The more you can do, the more valuable you are, the more likely they are to keep you around. So I could catch the football. I mean, you can pretty much teach anybody to catch a football. But blocking is a whole different ballgame. I mean, there's a lot of a heart that's involved. There's a lot of physical, and a lot of guys, they don't like that physical part of it. For us at Georgia, physical, the more physical, the better we were.
What were those Clemson-Georgia football games like back then?
oh, wow, I'm excited about the renewed rivalry. It was always one of those dates that we circled on our calendar, and every year that I was there, we opened up with Clemson. And the schools are very close to each other, and both teams travel very well. And I'm excited about them cranking that back up. But we had a lot of close ones. Came down to the last second field goals. I think David Treadwell was the kicker. We had Steve Crumley and John Casey. And it always came down to last possession, field goal, and that's the way that I expect it to be this year.
What's, do you have any stories, like amazing stories or memories from either a play that you made or just something that sticks out from one of the fiercest games? Because I know you played in that game for every year, 4 years while you were there at Georgia. What's a story that sticks out that you tell other people, everyone, about what it means or something that stuck out from one of the games you played against Clemson?
All right. Well, this is a little embarrassing, but one of the years, our center, his name was Pete Anderson. He was an All-American. He was known as the bell cow of the offensive line. And we were on the goal line, and a running back fumbled the football. Well, they fumbled it. It went into the end zone. It was laying right next to my leg. I didn't even know it. And next thing I know, Pete Anderson jumps on the football, and he became the hero of the game because he scored a touchdown. The center, an offensive lineman, scored a touchdown, and he was running around on the sidelines. And I'm thinking to myself, it could have been me. It could have been me.
Those moments, man, it's almost like I think it was so many times you see those things, you see those videos, but it's rare that you talk to somebody that's actually lived a moment like that. I could have been the one. I could have been the hero, but no, unfortunately, it's somebody else.
Oh, Coach Dooley was sitting there in the meeting, and he goes, Troy, how could you not see the ball? It was right next to your leg.
I mean, to laugh, but I'm laughing with you because I have been there. I've made mistakes. I've been there where I have embarrassed myself, and it's just enjoyable to know that I'm not the only person that's human that has those mental flops or just mental moments where you're not aware of what's going on.
Well, I mean, watching it on film, it was a little embarrassing, but thankfully we ended up on the winning side. And it really did put Pete Anderson on the map.
If you could, and I wasn't planning on going here, but I understand today's athlete, well, today's college football fan might not understand the importance or what bowl games meant back then when you were playing the college football. What were bowl games like to you and your teammates back then? It's kind of, to me, I call them an end of the season celebration. That's me as a little bit younger than you are, but you were there firsthand playing in those games. What did bowl games mean to you guys?
It was a reward for your season. I mean, ultimately you wanted to be the conference champion and be recognized that way. But when you play football in the SEC, a lot of the teams beat up on each other throughout the season. And if you're not lucky enough to come out on top, it's a reward for the team and the effort that was put into that season. And it was also another opportunity, Georgia, I mean, to put on that iconic helmet, to go out there in the silver britches and play one more time with your teammates. And that was one of the things. Now I see that these players, you know, they opt out because of a COVID virus. They opt out because they don't want to get injured. They want to go ahead and start working towards the combine. And I completely understand that. But for me, I mean, and I can only speak for myself, is that it was very important that I finished what I started with my teammates, because we truly were a band of brothers.
That's a good word, a good phrase to use at the end there, band of brothers. And I have been a pusher or a proponent or someone that believes that athletes should finish what they started. Athletes should end up. Of course, it could be a little selfish of me being a fan and also a podcast host for saying, well, I want the athletes to play because I think they should. And you're saying, well, it's because you're a podcast host. You want something else to talk about, which is true. I do. But I do enjoy watching high caliber athletes, the elite of the elite at that level, playing in games. And the bowl games, it is an end of the year celebration. It is a reward, like you mentioned, because all year long, no matter if you play 10, 11, 12 games, if you're bowl eligible, that means something. And if you're able to go out on a bang and beat another team that has a reward of their own, to me, that means a lot. And just hearing you talk about it, it sounds like it meant a whole lot, not just to you, Troy, but your teammates as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and to the university. I mean, if you got to go out there for the University of Georgia football program, you want to go out there with the team fully loaded. You don't want to go out there missing three or four players, and those players are probably typically your key players. So that was very important, and I still remember my last Gator Bowl and that last opportunity to go out there and play. We played Michigan State, and we beat them 35-28, and it was one of the most memorable games that I had the opportunity to play in because it was my last.
Yeah, those last ones always stick out. Troy, I'm curious, and I went back and looked at the 1988 College Football All-American teams. Now, this is a combination of a few different, I'm sure, different teams that came out during that time period. But some individuals that were College Football All-Americans when you were on this team, on this year, Troy Aikman from UCLA, Steve Walsh from Miami, Rodney Pete from USC, Major Harris from West Virginia, Anthony Thompson from Indiana University, Barry Sanders from Oklahoma State, Tim Worley, your teammate, which you mentioned, from Georgia, and then also Charles Arbuckle, another tight end from UCLA, and then ultimately, everyone will know this name, Deion Sanders, Florida State. When you hear those names, I didn't list off a lot of them or all of them, but when you hear those names, what does it mean to you to be a college football All-American?
The first thing that pops into my mind is that these are elite players. Going back to what I talked about a little bit earlier, it showed that the people that voted for the Walter Camp All-American team, the team that I made, they're voted on by head coaches and sports information directors. It's not fans. It's not sports writers. So to be able to have the head coaches and the sports information directors be the ones that voted on that, it showed me that they were looking as an overall player. And that was really exciting for me because, like you said, Charles Arbuckle, there was another tight end out of Iowa, Marv Cook. These guys, they caught 60 passes in one season.
Oh, wow.
I started four seasons and only caught 42 passes. So it went and it showed me that they looked at more than just statistics. And that was very quite an honor that they thought of me as the best tight end in the country.
I'm sure at this time, before going into the NFL draft or having your name possibly in the draft, you may have taken some time to reflect on what it meant to be a Georgia Bulldog for 4 years, a four-year starter, college football All-American, all of those things. What does it mean to you to be a Georgia Bulldog football player?
Well, I don't know if you remember, there was a gentleman that wrote for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He also worked at CBS Sports, Tony Barnhart. Tony Barnhart was a graduate of the University of Georgia. I met him, but he was writing a book called What It Means to Be a Bulldog, and he asked me if I would do a chapter in his book, and I said, absolutely. One of the things that really stood out to me was it was like a family. You know, I go back and I mentioned the band of brothers. We were together for 4 and 5 years. We went through everything. My mom died from breast cancer. My roommate, Scott Adams, his dad died. Mike Brown, a linebacker, his mom passed away from breast cancer. So we were there for each other. And those are the things that I remember. When my mom was able to come to the games, they gave her a parking pass where she was able to park right outside of Sanford Stadium. And Hornsby Howell, who was an associate athletic director, would go out, wheel a wheelchair out, pick her up, take her up to her seat, and before halftime, he would go pick her up, take her down to the recruiting box so she could get some air, get out of the heat. Then he would wheel her back, and then after the game was over, he would go pick her up, wheel her down to her car, and put her in her car. That's what family does. And those are the things that I truly remember. Charles and Debbie Whittemore, my position coach, and his wife, they poured time in us off the field. We were invited to their house. Back then, that's when you could go to the coaches' houses. Now they look at it as improper benefits. But we were able to go over there and have cookouts. He would ask us to go to church with him, Sunday school, things like that. We'd have Sunday brunch after church with the family. And those are the things that I really, truly remember. I mean, I got a lot of stories and memories from games, but the things that really stand out in my mind are those things that the Whittemores did, and Hornsby Howell taking care of my mother. Even Coach Dooley, great football coach, legend, an even better friend. Even to this day, he comes and does autograph signings around Christmas time in Woodstock, Georgia, and we go up there as a family and see him every year.
What impact did Coach Dooley have on your life? Then going back to that time period then, and maybe some things that happened then that stick with you now to present day.
I think one of the biggest things is that every time that you step onto that field, you go out and you try to be the very best player that you can be. That's one of the things he taught: hard work, teamwork, toughness, and that's how we played. You kind of take the role of your coach and their personality. And like I said, you know, if we didn't rush for over 350 yards, it was a bad game.
I wonder how some of those practices were if you didn't reach your rushing goal at the end of the game. Because I'm sure that following practice, or maybe even right after the game, Coach Dooley kind of ripped into you guys and said, look, we got a goal. We didn't meet it. And people like yourself, Troy, and your other teammates were like, man, practice is going to be tough because we didn't do the things we were asked to do.
Oh, yeah, and they had that. I mean, if you the coaches graded us on every play, and if you got a winning grade, you became part of the Victors Club. It was an elite group. It just meant that you won more battles than you lost. We'll just make it simple that way. But, yeah, I mean, back then when we had 4 or 5 weeks to get ready for the season, there were no helmets and running around in your shorts and T-shirts. It was full pads all the time. We never wasted a day. And a lot of the days, a lot of the practices, we would finish up with what they called the Oklahoma drill, where they put two dummies on the ground, offensive player versus defensive player. A running back would carry the football. The offensive player would try to block the defensive player. The defensive player would try to shed the offensive player and make the tackle. The whole team would be gathered around, and it was just mano a mano. But that's what brought us together as a team. Those times going down to Sanford Stadium on Saturdays and having a 3-hour scrimmage. That's what it's all about. That's where teams are built.
That's going back to those days. I'm sure you guys probably had two-a-day football practices leading up to the start of the season. And I think those have been outlawed in a lot of states lately because the health, the safety that they're proclaiming. But when I played, I had two-a-days, and I didn't – I mean, you just got used to it. You got to practice. You got a little break. You got another practice. You're in the heat. I mean, it was just what you – what you were used to, and it kind of got your body ready for the football season. And from what you're talking about, from just hearing you, I venture some of those early preseason practices were a little intense and maybe had a fight or two because people were a little disgruntled based on the way things were going.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, being at the University of Georgia, I understood two-a-days and full pad practices. And when I got into the NFL, it didn't change. It actually got a little bit worse. I remember as a rookie with the Atlanta Falcons, it was like 5 weeks of two-a-days. But that's back then when they had a larger roster. They don't bring as many players to camp. But I remember walking in the first day, there's 150 players. I'm number 7 on the depth chart.
Oh, wow.
I had a capital R in parentheses next to my name, identifying me as a rookie. It was one of those things. It was a war of attrition, last man standing, so to speak.
Last man standing is a great way to put it. Troy, we're almost out of time. I didn't get to hit any of the stuff I had planned for the NFL, but the college football Georgia Bulldog conversation we had was enjoyable. Do you have any last comments or last words you would like to leave the listeners, either about your time at Georgia, something going on present day in your life in America, or anything like that that you would like to leave as kind of your last comments here on the podcast?
Well, speaking to all the young athletes out there, a lot of us have rare opportunities to be able to do that and to play at such a high level, going from high school to a major college football program and then going to spend 10 years in the NFL. I was living a dream, but it was a lot of hard work. And one of the things that I always tell the younger kids that I come in contact with and are able to talk to is that never let anybody outwork you. Every time you step on the football field or baseball diamond, basketball court, whatever it might be, never let anybody outwork you. Hard work, dedication, it pays off. And one of the things, I'll tell you one last quick story. When I got to the Kansas City Chiefs, there was a quarterback, Steve DeBerg. And the very first day of practice, as a tight end, if there's a blitz, we got to break our route off. We become the hot receiver. He dumps it to us. Well, I didn't recognize the blitz. He threw the football and hit me right in the back of the head. It was a little embarrassing. We get to the meetings that night. He's running the clicker back and forth with the laser pointer, and people are laughing. I'm ready to start crying and sneaking out the door and just leaving. And he looked at me and he says, "I bet you think that I'm making fun of you, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, it kind of looks that way." He said, "No, I'm not." He said, "I want you to understand, this is 11 on 11. All 11 people on offense have something they're supposed to be doing on every play. And if everybody does what they're supposed to do all the time, it's like a well-oiled machine. But if one person breaks down, the whole machine breaks down." And what I'm trying to teach you is that it's not 11 on 11 beating the snot out of each other. There's a lot more to it. And when one person messes up, somebody can get hurt, and typically it's me, the quarterback, and I don't want to get hit because I don't like being hit. From that point on, I never made another mental error in the game. I took it and studied all 11 positions on the offensive side of the football. I wanted to know what everybody was doing on every single play. I studied the defense. I studied my opponent because I wanted to know what the offense, what are we doing and why are we doing it if they give us a look? I wanted to understand football. And from that point on, I saw the game differently. It sped things up for me as well. I was able to play faster because I didn't have to slow down to try to read and figure out what everybody was doing. I just reacted naturally. And it's just that dedication of working hard and going out there on the field and never let anybody outwork you and understanding what you're supposed to do. When you do that, it's a beautiful thing.
It definitely is. Troy Sadowski, this has been fun, very enjoyable to hear you here on the podcast talking about your playing days, some memories, and a story just like what you just told. Troy, thank you so much for coming on the Jay Stevens podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, fantastic. I would love to come back. I got a lot of premium stories, my friend.
Week number one, Clemson and Georgia meet again. I have been looking forward to this matchup for quite a long time. At the end of last season, when you look ahead to the next season and you look to see what matchups, what non-conference matchups that you don't normally get, that you're going to get right now or in the upcoming season, you're going to get this one. Of course, there are other numerous non-conference games that you rarely get that you're going to get this year. But Clemson, Georgia, week one, I'm here for it. And I know Troy is excited. I know you're excited. I know many people that are college football fans hope this is the start of a new trend for these two college football powers to play each other consistently. You know, Clemson recently got back to being a power in college football, winning national championships numerous in the past 5-6 years in the college football playoff era. But it wasn't very long ago in the 80s that Georgia won a national championship, which Troy mentions in the episode. There was a long drought for Clemson. There's been a longer drought for Georgia. They won championships around the same time in the 80s. Clemson has won more recently. And I think Georgia, this year, they're going to have a good team. JT Daniels at quarterback. They are hoping and planning to have an undefeated season and get to do something they haven't done in a long time, win a national championship. It all starts week one. Clemson versus Georgia. Get reunited, and I'm waiting. Oh, I am waiting. Can't wait for that game to be played. Thank you guys so much for listening and downloading another episode of the Jay Stevens Podcast. If you enjoyed what you listened to on this episode, I currently encourage you to head to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating and a review. It is greatly appreciated. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at jstevens07. You can also send all of your emails to jstevenspod@gmail.com. This has been episode 210 of the Jay Stevens Podcast. I will see y'all next time.